Virginia and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Non-Human Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Om Foods, serving organic, non-GMO whole foods, including wild-caught mahi-mahi, and having the largest vegan menu in downtown Chico. Om Foods serves homemade teas and lemonade, acai bowls, and smoothies blended with coconut water, and you can find them at 142 Broadway, just two blocks from Chico State. They're open Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. and on Saturday from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. with to-go and catering available. For more info, you can find them at iloveomfoods.com and on Facebook. And we're also made possible by Peterson Tree Care, because trees need care. John Peterson continues his family tradition of caring for Chico's amazing natural resource. Licensed, bonded, and insured with financing available, Peterson Tree Care handles residential and commercial properties and can be reached by calling 518-0924. This is KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Non-Human Radio. Good afternoon and welcome to show 1933, the August 14th, 2019 episode of Non-Human Radio, where we talk animal news, animal rights, and veganism every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico and streaming online at kzfr.org. What do we have coming up? Co-host Danny Toms, let us know.
On today's show, we'll have an update on the National Park Service plan to balance the interests of the Thule elk, a native wild species, with the interests of ranchers and dairies, followed by news from a university and a city that are working hard to make dairies and cattle ranchers obsolete. We'll end with some words of wisdom from Jenny Messina, better known as the Vegan RD, registered dietitian, on veganism, convenience foods, and privilege. We'll end, as always, with the Chico Vegan Calendar of Events. Jenny, take it away.
Thanks, Danny. Before I get to our first news story about the Thule elk at Point Reyes National Park, I want to give folks a word of warning about about blue-green algae and their dogs. Cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae, are microscopic bacteria found in freshwater lakes, streams, ponds, and brackish water ecosystems, all of which we have here in Butte County. These blue-green algae can produce toxins that affect people, livestock, and pets that swim in and drink from the algae-contaminated water. These blue-green algae grow and form these greenish paint-looking pea soupy type of blooms, and because these algae float, they may be blown by the wind into thick, concentrated mats near the shore, thus making them easily accessible to your dog. Concentrations vary throughout the year, but they are most abundant during periods of hot weather like we're having now, and are most likely to be found in nutrient-rich water. While most blue-green algae blooms do not produce toxins, it's not possible to determine the presence of toxins without testing, so all blooms should be considered potentially toxic. Very small exposures, such as a few mouthfuls of algae-contaminated water, may result in a fatal poisoning for your dog. Signs of poisoning are dependent on the toxin involved. There are neurotoxins and liver toxins, all with very dramatic symptoms, such as vomiting, paralysis, paleness, jaundice. For the neurotoxins, you'll see muscle tremors and drooling and muscle rigidity, all of which you just need to call your vet and get your pet into treatment as soon as possible. There are no antidotes for blue-green algae, but there are some palliative treatments like anti-seizure medication, oxygen, and other supportive supportive help. In Chico, our emergency vet is Valley Oak Veterinary Hospital. They are open 24/7, and they can be reached at 530-342-7387. You know, you may want to take a moment and put that into your phone contact list. You can also call the ASPCA Animal Poison Control Center for any animal poison-related emergency 24 hours a day, 365 days a year at 888-426-4435, and those will be posted with the show notes so that you can go reference them later. For the ASPCA Poison Control Center, their consultation fee may apply because you will be talking to a professional veterinarian or a veterinary nurse. All right, so keep an eye out on your dogs. Don't let them swim in the creeks or the ponds. They might get poisoned. So on to our news. The National Park Service released a controversial proposal last week that would provide support to Point Reyes ranches by culling tule elk and quadrupling the lease terms for these so-called working lands. Ranch leases for more than 26,000 acres in Point Reyes National Seashore and the Golden Gate Recreation Area could be extended up to 20 years, up from the current five-year type of terms that are now offered. Ranchers would also be given the option to diversify their livestock on a case-by-case basis, meaning that instead of just cows, they could have goats or they could switch to a dairy.
I'm going to sign a lease for 20 years to raise goats and in 2 years ask to raise cattle and in 3 years have something else.
Because I'm entitled to it.
I mean, this is obviously written by their lobbyists and given to the National Park Service.
Meanwhile, park staff will be allowed to shoot some of the free-roaming Drake's Beach tule elk herd, which have supposedly harmed livestock and damaged ranch property in the past. The herd would be limited to 120 elk, and the current population of those elk is now at 124 elk. Cicely Muldoon, Point Reyes National Seashore Superintendent, said she thinks the proposal strikes the right balance, saying, "By arriving at this, we protect the park resources, we respect the ranching heritage of the park, and I think demonstrate that these things are not opposed. There is room for us to support a free-ranging elk herd and preserve working ranches." The article goes on to say, "This proposal is one of several alternatives in the park's $950,000 environmental review as part of its ongoing general management plan amendment process. Alternative proposals had included ending all ranching or killing all of the Drake's Beach elk herd." So I guess in that sense, is a balance. The public can provide comment on that draft proposal during the next 45 days, with input being used to draft the final proposal. And I'll, a link to that comment page has been posted onto the Non-Human Radio Facebook page, as well as to the Chico Vegan Instagram. How to manage the conflicts between tule elk and historic ranches has already been hotly debated in Congress, courtrooms, the media, and in the public over the years. Some environmental groups decried the Park Service's proposal, saying it prioritizes private agricultural interests over the preservation of public lands and wildlife. Deborah Moskowitz, president of the Mill Valley-based Resource Renewal Institute, said that, quote, "On a quick first read, it just seems like the Park Service has basically rolled over and given the ranching interests everything that they've demanded." Another environmentalist, Jeff Miller, who is the senior conservation advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity, said that, quote, "Culling elk would do nothing to address the environmental harm caused by cattle ranches. What is the Park Service thinking? Allowing expansion of agricultural activities would inevitably lead to further conflicts with other native wildlife. After the elk shooting starts, get ready for ranchers to call for the killing of the park's bobcats, foxes, coyotes, and birds. And heaven forbid, a wolf finds its way there or a mountain lion, right?"
Yep.
Some observers, such as Representative Jared Huffman, a Democrat out of San Rafael, said that the 28,000 acres of ranch lands in the National Seashore and neighboring Golden Gate National Recreation Area are a historic and culturally important feature that should be preserved. While he supports the 20-year leases to allow ranchers some long-term certainty, Huffman had concern about the park's plan to manage the Drake's Beach elk herd. He told the Marin Independent Journal that, quote, "120 animals is a large herd, and the Park Service's record of managing the herds is not good, frankly." Like, he's an expert.
I wonder how good the ranchers are at managing their herds and their environments.
Right, exactly, yeah.
A 20-year lease is kind of ridiculous for animals that are basically killed once a year. So this talk about planning, 5 years sounded kind of short, actually, but 20 sounds like
I think
give them all they want.
What struck me is given our rapidly changing climate and year-to-year variability, asking for a 20-year lease to allow ranchers some certainty is just like, the certainty that they need is fixing our climate change issues and actually producing less methane from these cattle. Let's see here. The article goes on to say the 120 elk limit was chosen after the park staff consulted with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and other national parks on their own elk management practices. The park will continue to use hazing, fencing, and habitat development to keep the elk away from the ranches. Any elk culling will need to be approved by park administrators. So comments to that National Park Service proposal can be submitted online at parkplanning.nps.gov and look for the Point Reyes page on that. So that was a news story from the Mercury News, written by Will Houston and published on August 9th, 2019. So after reading that, I was quite curious to know about elk in the state of California. And it turned out the SACB had run a story on it, so I wanted to share that. This is a SACB article that was published back in July, just last month in July 2019. Before Europeans arrived in what is now California, there were more than 500,000 Tule elk roamed California from present-day Redding down to Santa Barbara. That means where we are right now, there were once Tule elk.
Yeah.
By 1870, that population had dipped below 10. By some accounts, there were only two or three elk. What or who pushed the elk to the brink of extinction? For one, Gold Rush-era settlers overhunted Tule elk for hide and meat, said Joe Hobbs, former statewide elk and pronghorn coordinator for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Farmers diverted rivers and drained wetlands for more productive fields, shrinking the species' grazing range. They planted invasive grasses to better feed old-world livestock, crowding out the plants Tule elk had fed on for millennia. As a result, by the time Elk Grove, that was the focus of this little essay in the Sacramento Bee. Why is Elk Grove named Elk Grove, right?
It makes sense now. I just had no idea. I mean, it's like everywhere that's any subdivision that's Quail Hill. It's because, they paved over the quails when they built the subdivision.
Pretty much, pretty much.
Everything like that. It's just silly.
As a result, by the time Elk Grove was established by the mid-19th century, about 10 miles southeast of Sacramento, Tule elk, the smallest and lightest colored of the four North American elk species, were nearly gone from the region for good. James Hall founded the Elk Grove Hotel and Stage Shop in 1850 for travelers between Sacramento and the Bay Area. And that was how Elk Grove got its name. According to census figures, Elk Grove had fewer than 5,000 residents as late as 1970. By 2000, the year Elk Grove became an incorporated city, that number was closer to 60,000. And current estimates put it at around 173,000 people. Human settlement, even in communities named after the Tule elk, has spelled doom for the species' chance at free grazing. In other words, as Elk Grove grew, it became less and less likely that any elk could live there again. In 1870, the species that had once grazed alongside the Sacramento River was believed to be extinct. Then a handful were found on private property in Kern County. Several failed breeding programs, a few successful relocations, and one federal protective bill later, they've made a comeback. Tule elk have flourished along California's coastal range as far north as Mendocino County in a variety of accommodations, said Hobbs, who grew up in Elk Grove. This includes Bureau of Land Management controlled land, fenced herds in Point Reyes, federal military property, private estates, and state wildlife areas in San Luis Obispo County. But from Stockton to Bakersfield, millions of acres have been devoted to agriculture, housing development, and transportation infrastructure. Even the Grasslands Ecological Area in Merced County, the best candidate for raising elk populations in the valley, Hobbs said, is crisscrossed by highways. Elk will never again roam the Sacramento area like they did when James Hall arrived in 1850. Today, California is home to around 5,900 Tule elk, and each one is a descendant from the handful found in Kern County 149 years ago. Hobbs said that the population will continue to increase, but only to a degree. The elk's grazing range will never be what it was before European settlement. So that's just a little history on just one species that used to be quite prevalent in California. You could, along with the elk, probably went many, many other species to say goodbye to.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have enough time for all my comments on this, but if you go back to the beginning of this article about trying to accommodate the ranchers in Marin and wherever that is.
Point Reyes.
You know, the legacy of accommodating ranchers and farmers in California has been massive decline of species, massive destruction of the environment. Who introduced the invasive grasses? Ranchers. Who killed all the predators that causes too many, ungulates and deer and other things to be around? Ranchers, for sure.
So
this idea that we've got to accommodate them and their culturally sensitive practices of having, imported cattle and had them there for 50 years, it's not the way to manage the environment.
All right, you've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. If you want to follow more current events and animal rights-related news, I invite you to follow the Non-Human Radio Facebook page. Over to you, Danny.
Next, we have cafeteria news from merry old England in an opinion essay in the Guardian newspaper. Goldsmiths, a public research university in London, England, now has a beef-free cafeteria.
Woo-hoo.
It's not the only thing the institution is doing to become carbon neutral by 2025, but it is the first, the simplest, and somehow the most inspiring. Once someone else's cafeteria has gone beef-free, yours has to have a really good reason not to. Just look at the spread of the Beyond and Impossible burgers amongst fast food chains, which people would have said was impossible a year. Well, to belabor the phrase, was unlikely a year ago.
Inconceivable.
But once it starts, the ball starts rolling. There is an argument to be had that this obsession with personal choices distracts us from the urgent necessity of structural change. This is certainly true of schemes such as Earth Hour, which asks us to turn off our lights for an hour, presumably, so that we can see what life will be like after an environmental apocalypse. But the population at large moving on to a plant diet will ultimately be one of those structural changes, and such transformations happen incrementally. Think of smoking. One day they banned it on public transport, and wham, 30 years later, you can't do it almost anywhere in public. Wouldn't it be more environmental to cut out meat altogether? Beef has an unbelievable footprint. It requires 28 times more land and 11 times more water than pork or chicken, with 5 times more carbon emissions, which include but are not limited to flatulence. Concentrating on beef is a useful statement of environmental intent. It's much more useful than trying to persuade people to give up cars. In the future, we can hope to see milk-free cafeterias too, although there will be many struggles and battles with the dairy lobby.
I thought that was nice, and I thought, it's possibly true. If this college did it in London, perhaps we'll see more follow in its wake.
I mean, recently there's a bunch of comfort foods in England, little kind of meat pies and dough. I forget what they call them, pasties or various things that it's kind of like everybody gets the bucket of KFC. They've got their kinds of things like
right.
that. And over the past year, there have been vegan versions of those. And, the first 2 days, there's a bunch of scoffing and guffawing, and then they sold out.
Yep.
And then they added more, and then they sold out. And now it's a huge thing. So I think, the tipping point is there, which is great news.
All right. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM. Back to you, Danny. Story number 3.
At its July City Council meeting, the city of Emeryville Council unanimously approved a Green Monday resolution in partnership with social venture group Green Monday US. This makes Emeryville the second city in the nation after Berkeley to adopt the program. I used to work at an office in Emeryville, so I had to go look this back up again because it's always confused me as to what it is and why it exists. So Emeryville is about 2 square miles Berkeley on the coast. It's just this little tiny strip of land. And I actually read the history of Emeryville, but I didn't have a good reason as to why it just wasn't merged into Oakland or something. Maybe I'm offending the founders of Emeryville right now. My apologies. Nevertheless, this makes Emeryville the second city in the nation after Berkeley. It's one of its neighbors to adopt this Green Monday resolution. City-run facilities and programs will provide plant-based foods on Mondays, and the council itself will procure vegan food for its meetings.
Pretty awesome.
Which is pretty awesome because it usually is vegetarian when they do stuff like this. Or it's an option. Programs to educate the public on the environmental advantages of plant-based food choices will be held at various locations in the coming months. Educational materials will be available at libraries and community centers. Restaurants that add plant-based items to their menus will be issued Green Monday stickers and recognized on the forthcoming Emeryville Green Monday website. The resolution, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, finding that the livestock sector contributes 14.5% of anthropogenic GHG emissions. What's a GHG emission?
Greenhouse gas emissions.
Livestock sector contributes more than the entire transportation sector. So you can buy all the Priuses you want, but if you're eating hamburgers, you're doing harm. Emeryville's mitigation action, beef hamburgers, that is. Emeryville's mitigation action plan for 2030 within its climate action plan includes an objective to reduce consumption-related emissions.
You know, Chico, City of Chico has a climate action plan, and they're undergoing some scoping sessions for it as it keeps going through different iterations. So there's going to be a meeting on that later this month that I would encourage folks to attend and ask, what about Chico consumption?
I can't wait to read the comments on Facebook. There is still considerable debate by omnivores whether plant-based diets are better for our health or the planet. Many suggest a shift in livestock practices that includes pasture-raising and grass-fed animals, which they claim can offset the carbon impacts of raising animals for slaughter. The Savory Institute is an example of an organization promoting its theory of proper grassland management. Both sides agree that so-called factory farming is not a sustainable practice. There's not nearly enough grass pasture in the world to continue at the current rate, however. The Factory Farming Awareness Coalition, FFAC, a national educational nonprofit, introduced the initiative to Emeryville's Sustainability Committee in May, so that's a pretty quick turnaround. Green Monday founder David Young congratulated the city of Emeryville from his Hong Kong offices, saying that Emeryville is setting an example for cities around the world.
Yeah, I thought that was a fascinating little story. I think that, you know, Emeryville could serve as a model for Chico and for other cities that claim to be sustainable.
I mean, I'd like to, you know, it sounds like Berkeley did this. You go over to Emeryville, and now if we can get, you know, get over to San Francisco, you know.
Yeah, they did get over to Amsterdam. We talked about this in one of our May episodes, where Amsterdam plans to serve vegetarian food, not vegan food, but vegetarian food by default at all its catered events in government buildings. And meetings in the Dutch capital of Amsterdam will be meat-free unless attendees specifically request otherwise.
Which is great. I've been to too many kind of corporate meetings, and so much of this food gets wasted anyway because somebody ordered it to make you work through lunch, and you just like, I want to eat this anyway. I didn't get a choice, and, you know, it seems kind of bizarre to omnivores sometimes that people would want to order the food they want and not just like, we got you a bunch of random stuff. Aren't you happy? You know, so... what do you got, Jeannie?
All right. We're going to end up with a nice essay by an activist and registered dietitian who I really respect, Jeannie Messina, who goes by the Vegan RD as her blog page and her Facebook page. And she is writing about the Impossible Burger, the Beyond Burger, these things that are very, very meat-like. And she starts out this essay, "Lately it seems that every restaurant chain is scrambling to add some type of vegan meat to their menu. And these new products are so excellent that they appeal to vegetarians and meat eaters alike. Is this good news for vegans, or are we all going to suddenly keel over and die now that we can eat fast food just like the rest of America? Detractors, including some plant-based diet advocates, are quick to point out the processed nature of these new burgers. They say that people are being led astray if they believe that these are healthy alternatives. Some even suggest that the health of vegans is suffering because of all the new vegan products on the market." So this is, you know, we vegans can take a look back at ourselves and be, you know, critical, and that's what this is about. "It's not like there have never been vegans with heart disease and cancer before veggie burgers came along, nor is the availability of processed vegan foods some new phenomenon. Oreos have been vegan for 25 years. Potato chips have been vegan since forever. When I worked for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine back in 1990, we cooked up Boca Burgers, which was made from soy protein isolate, in an electric frying pan in the office on a regular basis. Vegans looking for treats haven't needed to wait until Impossible Foods teamed up with Burger King to find them. It's true that these foods are easier to find now. It's also easier to find vegan foods made from unprocessed ingredients. When it comes to vegan foods, we have a pretty extensive range of choices these days. And while a steady diet of highly processed foods isn't the best choice for health, it doesn't mean that you need to eat only whole food plant foods if you want to be healthy. That's a perspective that plays into fears around food choices. It burdens people with undue worry about whether every single bite of food they can take will protect or harm their health. Eating is not quite that precarious. If you are consuming plenty of fruits, vegetables, and fiber, plus foods that provide healthy fats, enjoying a fast food veggie burger once or twice a month is not going to make or break your health. So basically, please, vegans, don't be harping so much on the health benefits of a vegan diet.
Every single Impossible Burger post or Beyond Burger post on the internet is first comment is somebody talking about, do you know how much fat and salt these have?
Yeah.
Can you make me a plant-based, no fat, no salt, gluten-free burger? And I'm like, well, they've been making those for 40 years and they taste terrible and nobody buys them.
Exactly. She goes on to write, some vegans have raised questions about whether the Impossible Burger is truly vegan. I could add to the already excellent articles on the topic from Better Eating International and Lifelong Vegan. For others, the decision about whether to eat a fast food burger is less about the burger and more about the practice of supporting these restaurants. But it's important to consider that for some people, these eateries are a helpful, albeit imperfect, option. For whatever reason, physical limitations, cognitive limitations, lack of facilities, not everyone is able to cook all their meals at home from scratch. Absolutely. Sonora Taylor, author of the book Beasts of Burden, Animal and Disability Liberation, says that despite problematic issues associated with the fast food industry, a radical change in our food system must not shame those who are on the front lines of food inequity. Inexpensive and accessible food is important for people with limited money and who live in food deserts, and this includes many disabled people. Ability and access aside, some people simply don't have the time or energy to cook. And yes, it can feel soothing to meditatively stir up a pot of soup crafted from homemade stock that you've prepared from carefully saved and cleaned vegetable scraps.
And Jeannie does make her own stock. She knows where she speaks here.
I have made my own stocks, but I don't necessarily make it currently. But maybe that's not practical for a single parent who also works two jobs outside of the home and just needs to get dinner on the table without taking time to feel all zen about it. Likewise, chopping vegetables is not relaxing and calming for someone who lives with chronic pain. Sometimes cooking is a difficult chore. Sometimes it's just one more task on a too long to-do list. Also, some people don't like to cook, which incidentally is not a moral failing. People have different needs, priorities, resources, and abilities. The idea that everyone should choose only healthy foods, only home-cooked foods, and only whole foods comes from a place of privilege. To be sure, veganism itself is a privileged choice. Not everyone in the world has the option of choosing what they will and won't eat. Bringing veggie burgers to fast food restaurants isn't the answer to that complex issue. But it does make a difference for some people. Everyone deserves to have vegan food available to them, regardless of their priorities, their food habits, or their resources. And no less important, meat eaters are far more likely to consider the ethics of veganism when they have access to delicious vegan food. For anyone who eats at fast food restaurants, it simply cannot be a bad thing for them to have the option of a tasty, appealing vegan burger. So I just really like the way she brings in the whole idea, like, you know, someone Googling vegan, you know, how to go vegan will be bombarded with plenty of websites that tell you how to cook everything from scratch and how to make yogurt from scratch and how to make tofu from scratch or how to eat super healthy by only whole food, plant-based, minimally processed foods. And that's great. But as she points out in this article, there's like clearly some people who that is just not an option for or a desire for, and that is not a moral failing.
Indeed.
I give Jenny Messina kudos, a link to that article, which I would highly recommend folks to read and share, even if you're not vegan, as food for thought. All right. Well, you've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. We are at the end of the hour because we have gone on for too long. So I am going to skip the calendar of events. There are plenty of good things coming up, but we will not get to hear them. Show notes and links to the articles mentioned in today's show will be posted to the Non-Human Radio Facebook page and on Instagram at Chico Vegan. This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM Chico. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers.